Terminology is important. The U.S.-Israel collaboration, we need to reframe this. It's not aid, it's investment.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall David I.
My guest today is the Chief of Staff of U.S.-Israel Education Association, a nonprofit organization that works in Capitol Hill to illuminate politicians both from the left and the right about Israel, what it means to the U.S. government, and what they can do about it. Here I am with Joan Leslie.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And I have to say before we begin, there is a word that I really dislike, but we keep using because we don't have another word yet, and that's ally. Ally means that you are helping someone else in their fight. And the reason I don't like that word is because I don't feel like non-Jews like yourself are helping Jews, but you're actually fighting your own fight, which happens to be the same fight as the Jewish and Israeli fight.
That's so true.
But for lack of better word, you're one of the strongest allies, you and your organization, but you're the chief of staff. Before we get to the organization and everything, there's a lot to talk about. I want people to first get to know you. So, Joan Leslie, what are you fighting for?
It's so exciting to be here and have this conversation with you because I am a Christian. I grew up a Christian in the South. I actually didn't know that many Jewish people growing up. And then I went to college and one of my closest friends was Jewish. And it was around that time in college that I became aware of Israel and felt a really strong calling to support Israel and the Jewish people. And I had a love for government and politics. I always thought I would go into that sphere. And this work that I'm doing now feels like such a perfect, segue between the two of faith and wanting to support Israel and the Jewish people from that perspective, but also from the political and security side as well. And so when you ask, what am I fighting for? I think, I began this fight before October 7th, 2023 in the war, and we've continued it since then. And I think we're fighting to ensure that the United States is always going to be one of the countries that is supporting Israel. And you said you don't like the word ally for that reason. It feels like a one-way street. Well, when we're working with members of Congress, we always talk about how do we strengthen the U.S.-Israel collaboration? Because it works both ways. For years, there was this perspective that the United States is just giving money to Israel and we're just funding their missile defense programs or different types of activities, but we gain so much from supporting Israel. So it really is a collaboration. So we're fighting to make sure that the United States is always standing as a strong partner, ally, and collaborator with Israel.
And we're going to get to all of that because there's so many incredible things your organization does. But I want to kind of like delve a bit deeper into that calling.
Yeah.
That you use the word calling, and the word calling is a very faith-based or spiritual word. So what was that calling? Why did you feel that? Why Israel? There's so 193, if I'm not mistaken, other countries in the world.
Yeah, I had a mentor come into my life when I was in college. She's actually the founder of our organization, and she really taught the Bible to me from the Old Testament perspective of look at all of the biblical prophecies about modern Israel. We are actually living in an age and a time where we are watching what the prophets Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah were talking about, where they anticipated a modern Israel. And that, again, there are going to be nations that align themselves with and against Israel. And we want to ensure that the United States is one of those that is always supporting Israel. And so from there, it, like you said, it is a very deep faith calling to make sure that we're supporting Israel and the Jewish people. And so I started really understanding that when I was in college, and it just continued to grow. And, we're talking about how it's, the time of Purim right now. And it really does feel like for a time such as this, making sure that we're educating Christians about the importance of supporting Israel and the Jewish people, because there's a really complex history between Christians and Jews in the past, and making sure that our Jewish friends know that there is a genuine support from the Christian community right now and that we're not going to leave you guys.
So let's talk about that genuine support, right? Because there is a fraught history. You know, we can't escape history. History doesn't determine us, but it's still part of who we are. And there's a lot of skepticism, both in Israel and in the Jewish diaspora, when they see strong Christian, mainly evangelical Christians, supporting Israel, working with and for Israel. And the narrative typically goes like this. The only reason why evangelicals are helping us is because they need Jews to live here so that at the end of times, you know, we will fight that, you know, end of times war, we will die, and then evangelicals go to heaven. It's a very deep skepticism, you know. Can you dispel some of these misperceptions, and what have you heard? What do you think?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I just shared with you how I walked into this, and it was from such a pure place. And then as I got to know some Jewish people in the community that I was from, we were hit with so much skepticism. It's either what you said, you know, that Christians are just wanting Israel prepared for the end times and the second coming of Jesus, or if a Christian's talking to me as a Jewish person, their only goal is to evangelize me and share the gospel. And it shocked me. I didn't know that there was that stigma or that stereotype. And so I learned a lot in that. And, you know, there's so much replacement theology in the church where Christians have been taught to replace everything in the Bible where it says Israel with ourselves. So now, like, you know, we, you know, have taken over the Jews. It's a new covenant. And that's so false. And so I think I have had such a goal of not only supporting the Jewish people, but like I said, continuing to educate Christians that replacement theology is incorrect, and that we as Christians really look to the Jewish people as the roots of our faith, and that it has, when I'm working with Jewish people, it has nothing to do with evangelizing. It has nothing to do with the end times. It is purely a support to ensure that Jewish people feel safety and security wherever they live in the world, but then especially in Israel.
Have you experienced personally that skepticism, and how do you deal with it on the one-on-one basis?
Yeah, I have experienced.
And I should say, just before we start recording, you told me you've always thought of yourself as a Christian. When you came to Israel, all of a sudden people say, wait, you're an evangelical, right? It's like, because the distinction there is again, out of fear, out of, it's not a stigma so much as out of a fear of it, like, is this group going to help us and then drop us? Is this group using us?
Ulterior motives, right? Yeah, it is funny. I had never even heard that phrase before. I just thought I was a Christian. And then I got involved in the Jewish and Israel space, and everyone's like, oh, you're an evangelical Christian. And I think that as I've gotten more into this work, I've noticed, and we talked about this a little bit before recording too, that there was a big shift that happened after October 7th. So pre-October 7th, 2023, a lot of the Christian community did support Israel. It wasn't as well known. And, you know, I did meet Jewish people one-on-one who would have skepticism about my motives. But after October 7th, 2023, I think we really saw the Christian community rise up in support of Israel and the Jewish people to a new level. And in our Christian Bible, there is a verse in the book of Romans that says, God works all things together for the good, all things together for the good. And so you look at something that was such a tragedy and so devastating like October 7th, and you wonder what kind of good can come from this. But I've actually seen it really strengthen the Jewish-Christian relationship in the United States. And I think if that's something good that can come from this, and we can dispel some of that unease and skepticism between the two groups, how powerful can that be moving forward?
And what have been your experiences speaking with other Christians around the United States? And I'm not speaking about politicians and influencers, but just regular folk. And you know, you meet at the supermarket, you meet, you know, at the theater, you meet at work, you know, What have been your experiences?
Well, I think it's been an excellent education opportunity since the war started, because even in my own friend group, you have Christians who know, okay, I'm supposed to support Israel. It's God's land. It's God's chosen people, the Jewish people. But there wasn't an interest or an understanding of why, and going much deeper than that. And since October 7th, Israel's in the news almost every single day right now, for better or for worse. And so I watched it increase people's desire to understand why they should support Israel. And I think it's been really powerful in the Christian community, like I said, moving away from that replacement theology, asking really hard questions of ourselves as a Christian community. Why are we supporting Israel and the Jewish people? And, you know, what's the end game? It's actually just to support them.
Mm. And again, of course, this is just like, it's your personal anecdotes and experiences. Yeah. But to many Jews out there, especially in the United States, it feel like no one has our back. What would you say is the common view in the streets about Israel and about Jews in America? Is it supportive? Is it indifferent? Is it hateful?
From the Christian community?
From the Christian community in Alabama, for mm-hmm. example, where you're from.
I think there's so much support for the Jewish community that it can feel so sad to us sometimes how alone the Jewish community, especially in the United States, feels, where I'm saturated in a group of people that care so much and actually mm-hmm. want to give their lives to it and support it. And so I think that there is this gap where we're trying to make sure that the Jewish community understands and knows where the support is. And you can see it, I know we're talking more on like a lower personal level, but you can actually really see it on the high governmental level right now. Like when Prime Minister Netanyahu came to the United States last month, and one of the first meetings he had at the Blair House was with the evangelical leaders in the United States. And so I think even on that high level, Israel, from a geopolitical understanding, recognizes that the Christian community in the United States is actually some of our biggest advocates and allies.
Mm. All right, so let's get to the work of U.S.-Israel Education Association. What is the organization? What is your goal?
So we're an education nonprofit. That kind of differentiates us from other groups. We're not a lobby, but we are purely education driven. And we work to support the U.S.-Israel collaboration. So that's working with members of Congress. That's working with administration officials to make sure that the U.S. policy is always supporting Israel. And we're always growing ways to build that collaboration. And I can kind of get into what that means in specifics. But the primary ways we do what we do, first and foremost, we take congressional tours to Israel. So in 2011, our organization was the very first organization to take privately funded trips for members of Congress inside of the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, or the West Bank. So at that time, it was illegal under State Department law for federal funds to send Congress members into those areas of Judea and Samaria. So it required a privately funded trip. And so that's how we started. And we really believed that Congress members cannot sit there and help broker the peace process when they haven't gotten to all of the communities, heard from all of the people on the ground, and understanding why it's so important that that different people be able to live inside of that region. So that's how we started.
And you and one of the interesting things in your tours, and I actually want to get an overview of what a tour looks like, but one of the interesting things in your tour is that you take congressional members, not just to meet Jewish Israelis, but also Palestinians. And mm-hmm. specifically, you focus on Israeli and Palestinian business leaders.
Yes.
That could be surprising to some people, because some people might say, look, you're here to advocate for Israel. Why are you showing them? Right. Why are you meeting them with Palestinians? Which I think is incredible. So tell me the thinking about behind that and what happens.
Yeah, for nearly 10 years now, we've been working with the integrated business movement inside of Israel. So to me, it is the grassroots peace movement, where you have Palestinians and Israelis living inside of Judea and Samaria together. You know, in the news, this is the hotbed, having Jews and Arabs living next to each other in the West Bank. But the untold story is that you have thousands of them that actually want to work in business together. They want to build businesses together. They want to share employees together. There are industrial parks inside of the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria that employ tens of thousands of Palestinians that make four times the wages in Jewish industrial parks than they do in Arab industrial parks. And so from that, the premise is if we can build prosperity on a people-to-people level, because at the end of the day, everyone wants the same thing. Whether you're Palestinian or Israeli, you want to make enough money to support your family. You want your kids to have good kindergartens. You want to have a good health system. And you want to believe that the next generation is going to have more than your generation. So that's so fundamental and true for everyone. And that's what these people want. And they see business as the way to achieve that. So whenever there is some kind of political peace process that will be at the top, there is a movement that's happened bottom up that's going to be ready to support that.
Yeah, given that I am 41, as we discussed before we started taping, I grew up at a time when there was some hope in the Jewish-Israeli mm-hmm. community of peace. And we used to call that person-to-person peace, mm-hmm. right? Where we will work on the individual relationships. The government can do what they want. We will force them to get right into a peace agreement. So that's an interesting perspective. So yeah. So let's get to the congressional tours.
Sure.
How much appetite is there in Congress to go on tours to see Israel and the Palestinian territories?
There's actually a lot of interest. And I'm so proud of our U.S. Congress. I think we hear all of the negative things in the news. You know, it's always like the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so you hear so much negativity in the news. But the overwhelming majority of our Congress is so supportive of Israel. They want to travel there. I think sometimes there's an education gap, which is what we've really stepped in to fill, where most members go when they're a freshman, they get elected to Congress, they go to Israel their freshman year, and then they don't go back. And some of them are serving in Congress for decades, and they don't go back. And so that's where we've really stepped in to provide those advanced education tours for senior leaders that are on committees that are relevant to Israel. They're leading these committees. And so when you talk to them, they're so eager to go and they're so eager to fill that education vacuum that they have. And you see them wanting to go to both areas, the Jewish communities, the Palestinian communities. They want a holistic understanding of the narrative on the ground. And it's a narrative that's not being promoted in the news.
And is it a partisan appetite, or meaning members of one specific party, or is it across the board? What's the demographic that's interested in going to Israel?
It's very bipartisan. So we are a nonpartisan organization because we believe in the importance of working across the aisle. You know, you don't move the needle on anything if you're only ever speaking to a specific base, especially if that base already agrees with you. So the important part is to be able to take members of both the Republican and the Democratic Party to Israel, especially inside of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. And there is appetite. People really do want to go on those kinds of trips.
So what is a typical itinerary? Tell me if I, I can't because I'm not a citizen, at least not yet. But let's say I was a Congress member. I'm coming on your trip. How long is a congressional tour?
Yeah, so our trips are long. We take them for a full 7 days on the ground. And it takes a lot for a Congress member who is one of the busiest people in the world to commit to 7 days on the ground. But when they do, they get fully immersed in the culture and the people. And so we do a combination of things. You have, of course, all of your high-level governmental meetings, the prime minister, minister of defense, the ambassador. So you're really having the high-level briefings. But then we take them to meet exactly what we said with the people. So we take them to Hebron, where they go into a Palestinian sheikh's home. And the sheikh is talking about how he and his people want to be in peace with Israel. And they get to hear that narrative. And then we take them into Jewish communities where they meet with Jewish business leaders. We also do a lot on scientific research and development front. So really talking to that sector, the private sector, about what Israel has to offer. Of course, it's the startup nation. And then, you know, all of the defense works, working with different defense people who can talk about what is going to be the next layer of the missile defense system. How can the U.S. benefit from working with Israel on it? So we cover the gamut of topics, and we spend time in Jerusalem. Jerusalem. We spend time in the north. We do great briefings in the Golan Heights. So you really get like the 360 view of Israel on our trips.
And what are the typical reactions of Congress members that go on these tours?
I think it's that, why are we not hearing these things in the United States? You know, they're members of Congress. You expect them to have the best intelligence in the world, but they're actually not hearing some of the things that we provide with them. Like, I think specifically about when we go up to the Golan Heights, you have a view right into Syria, and you can see the true strategic nature of why Israel needs to have the mountains in that area, because you have Syria right on the border there, and we know what's happening in Syria right now. So they get one of the best briefings right there in the Golan Heights. And that's something that comes to my mind that they consistently talk about. And then what they always say is, we need to bring this back to our colleagues in Congress. So that's kind of the second thing that we do. We take them on the trips, but then we do a lot of follow-up on Capitol Hill, and we bring a lot of those speakers back into Congress to brief committees, to brief staff members. So we try to do that continuing education.
So if I'm understanding correctly, at least from what you're saying, it's not so much that people have a false perception of Israel, it's that they have no perception. They have large, glaring gaps in their knowledge.
Yes.
And you fill those gaps.
Yes.
But I do want to note something and get your understanding of this, because Congress members have a lot of gaps about many, many different countries. No one can know about everything in the world, even if we aspire to as much knowledge as possible. Why fill the gaps about Israel? I'm sure they don't know a lot about Vietnam. They don't know a lot about Mexico. They don't know a lot about China and France. Why Israel? You know, I understand you're faith-based, and now it's more just like your love for the place. But why do Congress members need that?
Yeah, so from a geopolitical and geostrategic level, Israel is our greatest ally, I would say, in the world, but certainly in the Middle East. They're living in a very hostile neighborhood where they have enemies all around them, and they are the beacon of democracy in that region. And we always say Israel is like our aircraft carrier. They're kind of our outpost in the Middle East. And I've heard multiple prime ministers, I've met with Naftali Bennett when he was prime minister, with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and they all say, we are willing to fight the fight here so that Americans never have to put boots on the ground. And so I think just from a security perspective, it's vital that we take members of Congress there and that we help increase their education, because they're standing for American values in the region. And we have to remember, if you kind of zoom out, you look at the head of all of the dissension in the region is Iran. And they call Israel little Satan. But who's the big Satan? It's the United States. And so we recognize that we have a vested interest in supporting Israel in the region.
Let's play a worst case scenario kind of situation. What happens if Israel doesn't exist for the U.S.? I know what happens to Israelis and Jews, unfortunately. But what happens to American Christians?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a loaded question. So, you know, let's just start with the members of Congress. From the security side, we lose all of our intelligence. So there's the Five Eyes, which is the primary intelligence collaboration between countries. Israel always calls himself the Sixth Eye, and they share more intelligence with the United States than almost any other country in the world. So we immediately lose access to intelligence in the region that wants to hurt us. And then also all of their defense technologies. You know, Iran has been developing ICBMs, those intercontinental ballistic missiles that don't just reach Israel. They could reach the United States potentially. So do we have defense weapons that can, you know, work against that and defend against that? So there's that side of it. But then from an American Christian perspective, I think it would just be the tragedy, like I said, the belief of the biblical prophecies, that the prophets in the Tanakh and the Old Testament understood and anticipated a modern Israel. And it's to fulfill a purpose. It's to be a blessing to the nations, to the people that bless Israel. And so I personally, you know, don't even believe that that could be possible, that there wouldn't be an Israel, but we do everything in our power to make sure that we're partnering with that so that it doesn't happen.
And Do you remember your first time visiting Israel?
I do. So it was actually my very first day on the job. I had just accepted the job. It was my dream job. I had never been to Israel, but like I said, I had really felt this calling. I was 24. I felt so young and so eager and excited. And so my first day on the job was in Israel, and it was on a congressional tour. So talking about drinking from a fire hydrant, you know, I was just inhaling information. And I remember getting there on the first day. And I was staying in this tiny apartment that actually overlooked the Temple Mount. I mean, talk about an amazing view. And I just thought to myself, I'm so thankful to be a part of this because it's so much bigger than me. Like, this is not about fulfilling a dream that I have or like a dream job, because that's so small. If you're just focused on yourself, that's such a small way to live. But I remember just looking at the Temple Mount and thinking like, wow, I'm so lucky to be a part of something that's so much bigger than I am and that I can actually make a difference here.
And what are your favorite parts of visiting Israel? And I should say, as we're recording this, you just got back from another trip to Israel last night.
Yes.
So thank you. You might be jet lagged, but you are incredibly more coherent than I am when I'm not jet lagged.
What
are your favorite parts personally of visiting?
Yeah, so I just got back. Like you said, I spent the last 2 weeks over there. I think one of the things that never fails to amaze me is the prevailing feeling of peace when you're in Israel. So, you know, you can be sitting here in the United States reading the news and it seems so scary. And people ask me that all the time. Aren't you afraid to go? And the second you land, you're in Tel Aviv and you're like, this is so peaceful. This is just a modern city on the beach. People are living their day-to-day life, and there's actually so much joy. And I think that's part of the unique resilience of the Jewish people, is despite all the persecution for thousands of years, there's just this joy and this resiliency that you feel it. It's in the atmosphere. And then, you know, you go to Jerusalem and there's so much peace there in Jerusalem. And so I think that's one of my favorite things, is just being in the environment, but then also getting to talk to my Israeli friends. You know, being my age, I'm 30, and 30-year-old Americans cannot understand what it's like to be a 30-year-old Israeli. You know, they've all served in the army. They've all served their country and done that duty. And to talk to them is so eye-opening to me, what they've had to face in their life. And it's built a strength in people that I actually honestly envy sometimes and wish more Americans my age had that sense of duty and patriotism.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I was in graduate school, because this was years ago, there was the Boston massacre, the Boston Marathon terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. People forget this wasn't that long ago, but there was a Islamist terrorist attack on U.S. soil, and for several days. And the reaction was Boston Strong, which was very impressive. Americans are Boston Strong.
Right.
And I remember seeing that and being, on the one hand, very impressed, and on the other hand, being like, yeah, this is how you react. Like, it's not that special. Like, you know, we don't walk around saying Israel strong. We just say like, yeah, that's what it means to be Israeli.
Right.
But you mentioned the 30-year-old. So it feels like there's a little bit of a generational rift. And I've looked a little bit at the past Congress members that have gone on your tours. They seem to be a bit on the older end. Mm-hmm. Are we fighting a losing battle with all the generational factors and social media and colleges and everything that's happening? Or is there hope there with the younger generation in Congress and as well just on the street?
Yeah. I think we're fighting a battle, but it's not a losing battle. And I think that's an important distinction. And what I'm seeing specifically in Congress is just ensuring that we are supporting those that stand in the middle, because you've got these far right flanks and far left flanks that, you know, they're going to be loud and they're going to be opposing and divisive, and they're not going to support Israel on both sides. But I think the majority is in the middle. And so if we can really support and educate members that are there in the center, then I think it's a fight that we can win. And I think that we can ensure that they continue to understand the importance of supporting Israel. And then I think with just the general population, it's interesting. We live in the most saturated educational environment in human history. You know, we have access to education at our fingertips at any moment of the day. But I think, you know, we become so desensitized, and I think we become so numb to information because there's so much of it. So I think that's where the people-to-people conversations become so important, and it kind of breaks through that noise. And so I think that the, and then having authentic conversations like this right here, where people can hear more on just the human level, the importance, I think that's how we're going to win that battle.
Yeah, I was on the way here today talking with Ilana, our associate producer, and we were talking about how everything political, once it reaches mainstream media, social media, it gets dumbed down, mm-hmm. and it gets polarized into two camps.
Right.
That one camp takes one extreme stance, and as a result, the other camp takes the other extreme stance, and people forget that the truth is somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. It's nuanced. Yes, it might lean towards one side or the other, but it's never, or almost never, the case that just one side is correct.
Right, and I think that takes a lot of humility from people that we're lacking, to be honest, in this day and age, is can I have really strong convictions that I hold to and adhere to, but I'm humble enough to admit that the person who is, quote unquote, on the other side of this debate from me might have some really true and poignant points that I need to consider. And so can we, you know, require that humility of ourselves. And I love to tell this story from one of our congressional tours. It was one of the best moments I've ever experienced on a trip, where we had gone through the whole week in Israel. This is day 7. The members are about to fly out, and we're all circled up talking about outcomes from the trip, because we don't just want to show and tell. We want to make sure that members go back and they're equipped with policy lanes that they can really run forward with to support Israel. So we're huddled up talking about these policy lanes. And I can't even remember how this conversation started, but I had a Republican member look across the circle at a Democrat member and ask his forgiveness for ways he had treated him in Congress prior to the trip. And he said, after these 7 days on the ground with you, it's really put us in close proximity, where now you're just a person, and now we have this bridge of a common love for Israel, and you're going to be my brother moving forward when we get back to DC. So it's just breaking down those boundaries and those barriers, the divisive rhetoric, and then people are just people.
Right. And the label, even mm-hmm. just the label Republican or Democrat,
right.
is meaningless,
right.
or almost meaningless. And it's constricting our thoughts. Once you label yourself something, you're unable to see the other side because it threatens your label.
Right.
Are there any tense moments in the congressional tours? Things where you feel like, ooh, you know, we need to diffuse this mm-hmm. situation?
There are. I think a couple of instances that come to mind are actually never even about Israel. It's more about what they bring with them from Washington about other topics. I can think of some conversations I've been in. It was around the time that Roe v. Wade was overturned, and things were just really tense with the members at that time. And there were some conversations that I was like, oh, wow, I really want to diffuse this somehow. So those do happen, but I'd say they're, you know, not the majority. It's not the overwhelming majority of our time together. And like I said, when you sit at the end of 7 days, you look at this person and you're like, wow, you're actually a brother to me, or you're actually a sister to me, and we're actually fighting the same fight. We want to have a strong United States, and we want to have a strong United States that supports a strong Israel. And that just brings all of the tension down.
I like that. So you do the congressional tours, but you also do educational briefings on the Hill, on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
Before I get to the briefings themselves and what you're trying to achieve with those and how that work, I do have to ask, because some people might be listening and say, oh, it's the Zionist arm trying to affect politics. Is this a common thing that NGOs do educational briefings on different topics in Capitol Hill, or is this something that you've started that's new and unique to you?
So people definitely do it. I think, like I said at the very beginning, what makes us unique is that we're not a lobby. So when we walk into the door of a member's office, you know, we're not making this explicit ask. We're just equipping them with information and education, and then they get to decide what they do with it. And so it's not necessarily unique to us with the briefings, although I think that we have a reputation for doing them really well. Like I said, we know experts in every sector in Israel, and we've been really successful at connecting those experts with members of Congress on the committees that are related to their expertise. And so bringing them over, and you know, now we have Zoom, and now everyone just relies on technology and Zoom to conduct those briefings. There's nothing like getting someone in person with a captive audience. And that is how I think you educate effectively. And so I think we've done that really well.
So what kind of briefings do you give? When do you go up to Capitol Hill? What topics do you focus on?
So I mentioned we have policy lanes that we work on, and those evolve over time as the U.S.-Israel relationship does. But for us, we really right now are distilling those down into three main categories. So there's missile defense and emerging technologies. And, you know, the U.S.-Israel missile defense collaboration is the iconic collaboration. It's how I feel like our two countries have really worked together the closest over the past 10 to 15 years. You've got Iron Dome and Arrow and all the different defense systems. So that's one area we work on. And then you have the Abraham Accords, these historic peace agreements between Israel and its Arab countries in 2020. And there's been so much that's come out of the Abraham Accords in the last 5 years. And so we are doing a lot of different subcategories of that to support the building of the Abraham Accords. And then the third category is Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and understanding the geopolitical dynamics there. So each of those three buckets has different, you know, outshootings of different policy items that we're working on. But we've really been able to distill down. These are kind of the three themes amongst the U.S.-Israel collaboration. So when do we decide it's time to bring an expert to Congress is usually when one of those policy lanes has been picked up by a member and they're super passionate about something that we've provided education on. And they say, okay, I want to hold a briefing for my committee. You know, they might be leading the House Foreign Affairs Committee or a subcommittee on foreign affairs. And they say, I want to do a briefing for members and senior staff members. And who can you bring that's going to help us turn these pieces of education into legislation? And that's when we bring an expert in.
So you're almost like being asked to come and help.
Right, exactly.
So let's kind of like, and I want to delve into each one of those things because they are important. In terms of the missile defense collaboration, which is interesting because unlike many other countries where the U.S. actually sends American soldiers with American missiles to just defend a country, here it's a collaboration where it's Israeli defense forces, it's Israeli missiles, but in collaboration with the U.S. But a Congress member is responded to their constituents, and their constituents might say, hey, I am working hard. I am paying a lot of taxes. Mm-hmm. Why is my money going to fund an Iron Dome missile?
Right.
Why is my money going to fund a David Sling, you know, system? Like, how do you confront that issue with it? And that's a, you know, it's not a clear cut question.
No, it's not.
So how do you confront that with a Congress member?
I think it's pertinent now more than ever. I mean, we're having all these conversations about aid and foreign funding. And so why is Israel different? Why cut aid to other places, but Israel is somehow different? I think it goes back to what I shared, that they are our greatest ally in that region. And it is in our strategic interest to support a strong Israel in the Middle East as our beacon for democracy, for Judeo-Christian values, for intelligence needs. So there's all of that. But I also think, like I said, it really is a collaboration. It flows two ways. So when we put money into Israel's missile defense systems, they're then contracting back to American companies. Like, I'm from Alabama, and Huntsville in Alabama is known for its missile defense companies, and they're working contracted with Israeli companies. So it actually ends up bringing jobs back to Americans here in the States, and then we end up benefiting from their technology. So the United States doesn't need an Iron Dome. If you know about the different missile defense layers. You know, Canada might be.
Hopefully, we'll never need it.
Yes. Because it's lower level. So, you know, it would only ever be to intercept a missile coming from somebody on our borders, so Mexico or Canada. So we don't need an Iron Dome necessarily. But then you have David's Sling, which is more of the intermediate missile defense system. And then Arrow 2 and 3, which I was saying, you have countries like Iran that are developing these ballistic missiles that are intercontinental, and they want to deliver a nuclear warhead on these ICBMs. And so that's where we're going to end up needing defense systems that can intercept those kinds of missiles in outer space. And we're going to be wanting Israel's technology. So I'll share an interesting story from my organization. On our very first trip for members of Congress in 2011, we took the members to meet with the prime minister, and everyone was talking about this thing called Iron Dome, but nobody had seen it in operation yet, 2011.
Because it was just declassified then.
It had not even been declassified. Oh, not even. So it was on this trip that our team and the members of Congress asked the prime minister to declassify Iron Dome for the first time. And the next day, we took the first members to see an Iron Dome battery. So it's 2011. So these were all leaders on the House Armed Services Committee. They went back, they held a briefing on Iron Dome, and they got the U.S. budget tripled to $690 million to help build the Iron Dome defense system. After that, they got the batteries placed in Israel over all the population centers, Jerusalem, Haifa, and they were just on the border with Gaza. They got them in all the population centers, and it was not long after in 2014 that Israel was in a war against Gaza, where they actually had missiles that were mature enough to reach the population centers, but because Iron Dome was there, they were protected.
Yeah.
So that was such an immediate return on something that we did. And then the second one I'll say is Arrow 3. It was the same thing. In 2017, Israel had developed Arrow 3. It's the highest level of defense system in outer space. And they had nowhere to test it because you can't test it in Israel. It's tiny. And so they needed somewhere that had open skies to test it. And they really wanted to do it over Alaska. And the U.S. kept saying no, kept saying no. Well, the House Armed Services chair at the time, Mac Thornberry, came on our trip. We simply showed the Arrow defense technology to him. He met with military leaders, and he decided, we're testing this over Alaska. It was successful in 2017 in their testing, and then Israel used it for the first time in this war against Iran since October 7th.
Wow. That's incredible. I do have to say, when you were describing the Iron Dome, I think a lot of people don't realize how many lives are being saved by the Iron Dome. The reason why we're not seeing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of casualties on the Israeli side is because of the Iron Dome.
Right.
And I will never forget Trevor Noah. I don't remember if it was 2014 or 2021, but in one of those wars with Hamas, saying it's not fair that Israel has such great defense. Blaming the side that is better at defending its citizens for defending its citizens rather than using them as human shields was just so shocking to me. And I think the other point of it, I just want to emphasize what you said, which is so important. People imagine the U.S. aid to Israel as we're giving people money, like I'm just giving someone a gift. And it's in fact not giving people money. It's investing money because when Israel gets $4 billion a year, it's not a blank check. It's you have to spend it in the U.S., in certain industries, with Americans.
Right.
I was in the U.S. Navy, and my ship was built in Massachusetts. And most of our systems were built all around the United States, and we would have plaques saying this was in this shipyard, this was in that shipyard. And I was like, I was imagining all the Americans. They have no idea who I am, and I have no idea who they are. But we're working together on this.
Right. It's so true. And you nailed it. We've actually been talking about, terminology is important. The words you choose to use are important. And we've been talking about how with the U.S.-Israel collaboration, we need to reframe this. It's not aid. It's investment. That is exactly what we've been talking about. And you said that it is investment because it comes back on us and it supports us as Americans.
So I want to get to the third word in your four word name of your association. It's U.S.-Israel Education Association. Mm-hmm. And of course, as an educator, regardless if I'm allowed to teach at Columbia or not, I am still an educator and I believe in education. And I was especially drawn to one initiative that you do, which is your organization does, which is the AGES Fund. Tell me what AGES and AGES, what does that stand for and what is that?
Yeah. So after the war started on October 7th in 2023, we started looking at how can we be most effective in our education? What can we be bringing to Congress in light of the war and in light of anticipating a post-war scenario in Gaza? And we developed something called the Alternate Gazan Education System, AGES. And the idea was UNRWA, which is an arm of the UN, was filling this vacuum inside of Gaza. People think Hamas was in charge. Okay, they were in charge maybe politically and militarily, but they were providing zero civil services to their citizens. They were not running the trash. They were not running the mail. They were not running the health system. That was all done by UNRWA, this arm of the UN. So the United States gives to UNRWA, so do a lot of donor nations. And it all came out after October 7th that there were a lot of UNRWA employees that were involved with Hamas and participated in October 7th massacre against the Jewish people. And so one of the primary functions that UNRWA had in Gaza was the education system. And if you go in and you really get into the textbooks that they're providing, it is all incitement to terror. There is so much anti-Israel, anti-Jewish rhetoric inside of these textbooks that they give to Palestinian kids in Gaza. And it's no wonder that you have a completely radicalized population that's come up and they could do something like an October 7th. They literally teach math to, you know, second graders, and they teach it, if you have 10 Jews and you kill 5 Jews, how many Jews do you have left? Those are in textbooks provided by the UN with U.S. taxpayer dollars. And nobody was talking about it. And so we looked at...
I have another example. To me, the striking example, I saw a report on the UNRWA education mm-hmm. textbooks. I studied physics in high school. I was great at it and I hated it. and I remember studying like the physical forces of mechanic physics. And I saw it in an UNRWA textbook for 10th graders and 11th graders, which is when I studied it. They were studying mechanical physics based on angles of rockets, force of shooting the rocket, angle of shooting the rocket, and then you have to calculate where it will land. We used to do the same calculations with marbles, which is how you study physics in a democracy.
Right.
That shocked me.
It's shocking.
So how can you expect a 18-year-old Palestinian in Gaza or the West Bank to know anything else than hatred when starting in kindergarten, the textbooks teach you hatred?
Right. It's why I actually have an extreme amount of compassion and empathy for the Palestinian people. And, you know, that can be unpopular right now while tensions are so high and emotions are so high after an October 7th. But I look at, they didn't have a chance. They didn't stand a chance to believe something different because they've been radicalized from such a young age. And so we said to ourselves, okay, in a post-war scenario where Gaza will not be run by Hamas, the U.S. has now defunded UNRWA, thank goodness. What comes next? What fills that vacuum for education? So we said, let's create the Alternate Gazan Education System, the AGES Fund, which would be a new fund where the U.S. Congress could divert what we were putting into UNRWA into a new fund with a coalition of international partners. So you get Arab countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who have both already gone through this process with their own textbooks and curriculum. Through the Abraham Accords, which Saudi Arabia is not a part of yet, but I think they could still be a partner in this. You look at the UAE, after 9/11, they completely scrubbed their textbooks of anti-Israel rhetoric because they knew if we're going to be taken seriously as a modern nation and we don't want jihadism in our borders, we've got to take care of our textbooks. So there's a case for this. We've already seen Arab countries do it. So the United States can lead building this coalition of international partners, helping to explain to Germany and France why they need to defund UNRWA and fund this fund instead. And let's rewrite the textbooks, rewrite the curriculum. You've got to train teachers because you can have the best textbooks in the world. But if you have teachers that have been radicalized, it's not going to be effective. So you've got to have a program for teachers. And the whole idea is promoting peaceful coexistence. So we've done a ton of research on this. We've talked to a lot of different countries about it. Most recently, when I was in Israel the past couple weeks, we were having conversations with Israeli government leaders just to see what are they thinking about, you know, post-war Gaza. And so we have been able to provide this education to Congress, and it's actually been put into the Gaza Task Force in the House Abraham Accords Caucus. They're providing this Gaza Task Force day after plan, and the Aegis Fund has been incorporated into it.
What's the appetite for this education program in Israel?
So
from the Israeli side.
Oh, well, they think it's brilliant. I mean, they've been talking about this for years, sounding the alarms on UNRWA textbooks, both in Gaza and inside of Judea and Samaria and in East Jerusalem, which really is, I mean, you talk about people living right next to each other. East Jerusalem has the potential to be a hotbed if kids are incited to terror this way. So the Israelis are like, we've been talking about this for years. Nobody was listening to us. And it took an October 7th to expose the depth of corruption of UNRWA. And so they're ecstatic about it. And of course, it's always easier for the Israelis when the U.S. takes this kind of leadership on something like an Aegis fund. You know, Israel can try to promote it, but you really need the backing and leadership of the United States with Arab partners that are in normalized ties with Israel.
And you make a point in your policy paper, the white paper mm-hmm. that you publish, of saying Israel shouldn't be the one leading this.
Right.
Why?
Well, I think that part of it is you need to have Arab countries providing Arab education. You know, there's a cultural aspect of it there that not even the United States could fulfill. So that's part of it. But I think, too, for Israel's own sake, to give them just a step of removal from the process of, hey, we're not trying to take over Gaza. I think that's part of it. There's this idea that like Israel's going to try to take over Gaza, occupy it post-war. They're like, that's not what we're trying to do. We just want to make sure that we have neighbors that are not being incited to terror. So it gives Israel a little bit of cover. It gives Israel a little bit of separation so that it doesn't look like they're coming in and they're trying to occupy, which I hate that word, but that's what people say.
And in fact, it also gives it'll be more effective because if we, and I say we as Israelis, are seen as the bad person, regardless of the truth, we are seen as the bad person by many Palestinians, not all, mm-hmm. I don't know most, not most, but many, many Palestinians. The bad person can never come and say, let me teach you. Even if you're not
right.
bad.
Right, they won't receive it.
Because you won't be open to receive it.
Right.
I think education is the way forward. And ironically, I think education is the one thing that people from the extreme left to the extreme right can agree upon. I've had so many interesting conversations with people that are way farther left than I am, saying you can't blame the terrorists. They were educated. They were brainwashed this way. And I have had many, many conversations with people way farther right than me and extreme right mm-hmm. saying there is, you know, you have to kill them all because they have been brainwashed. Mm-hmm. You can't do anything about that. And I look at both of them, both sides, and I say, on the one hand, you can't absolve someone from their actions just because they were
right.
raised to do those actions. You got to hold people accountable. But I look on the other side and say, you can't blame people for being brainwashed by a system they had no control over. But the one thing you both agree on is the education is the problem. So instead of having this shouting match, why don't we all, you're coming at it from two different directions, why don't we focus on education?
Yes.
So I'm so glad that your organization is pushing that.
Well, I completely agree with everything you just said. I think that's such a great way to frame it from both sides. And I think that, you know, at the beginning, we talked about the integrated business movement that we've worked really closely on between Israelis and Palestinians. And I think after the war started, we realized, this is correct. This vision is correct and it is right. But what precedes business is education. You actually have to come up with a foundation of peaceful coexistence through education, and then you're more inclined to be in business together when you're an adult. And so I think it's just these layers of providing a grassroots peace movement, like I said, that can eventually support someday a top-down peace process. And I think I'd be interested to hear what you think about this, but I personally believe that October 7th shattered the paradigm of the two-state solution. I think the way people had thought about it since the Oslo Accords for 30 years has to be different now because of what happened on October 7th. And I think we need to have creative ways to be thinking about how to build peaceful coexistence between the two people, because both sides will tell you they were left so disillusioned after Oslo. They were promised something that never materialized. We've got to be thinking about this in a different way.
I'm in 90% agreement with you. I think it shattered something. I don't think it shattered a paradigm. I see it as almost you're hiking and you see the summit and you know it's going to be beautiful and you've been taking one path and you realize, no, this is a dead end. Mm-hmm. So you have to go back and take a different path. The summit is still there. The beautiful idea is still there. Mm-hmm. You just have to find the path towards it. And we might have thought that the path is going to be smooth sailing.
Right.
No, it's actually going to be a lot of ups and downs. There's going to be a lot of obstacles. We now realize that education is probably the number one thing that needs to be done so we can reach that. One of my favorite people in the world right now is Stav Cohen, who is, we talked about Duvdevan, the unit that inspired the show Fauda, but this is real life. But he goes around the US as well and talks about his experiences fighting for the IDF, his father fighting in 1973 war, his grandfather surviving Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And he says, in order to make peace, you first have to make peace possible. And I think that is the missing link from the quote-unquote Oslo Accords.
Right.
We jumped straight up to peace without start thinking, wait, let's first make peace possible and then peace. So I don't like when people give up on the idea of a two-state solution because we haven't found a path yet.
Right. Right. We just need creative ways to move forward and build peace between the people.
Before we end, I have two questions. The first question is, if you could send a message to non-Jewish Americans about why it's important for them to speak up about Israel, about anti-Semitism, about anti-Americanism, whatever it is, and how to do so, what would you say?
That's a great question. I would start by saying, people like to talk about Nazi Germany. And people like to say, I'd like to think that if I lived during that time, that I would have protected the Jewish people. I would have done something to save Jewish people, or I would have stood up for them. And I'm not an alarmist, but I would tell non-Jewish Americans that Nazi Germany didn't happen in a day. It didn't happen overnight. It was years of anti-Semitism being propagated by loud groups that eventually created that desensitivity that I talked about, that numbness to it. And I just want to encourage and really exhort non-Jewish Americans to stay vigilant about condemning anti-Semitism in every single form and anti-Israeli rhetoric in every single form, because it's a snowball effect. And we have to make sure that we cut it at the root. We have to cut that evil down at the root. So stay vigilant about it. Stay aware of it. And then to engage in conversations with our Jewish friends, to make sure that you're checking in on them, to make sure that they know their support on that individual level, and to make sure that we don't have any type of acceptance for anti-Semitism in our country, because it's actually anti-American, and it never just stops with anti-Semitism. It always goes to the next group, the next people. I'm getting my master's right now, and I'm doing a thesis on the roots of anti-Semitism. And this theory is scapegoating. It's human nature to want to make a group the other, but we have a responsibility to make sure that that does not happen here in the United States.
Which leads me to the next question, which is, what can our Jewish listeners, and myself included, do to strengthen the Jewish-Christian, not allyship, partnership in the United States?
I would just urge our Jewish listeners to embrace the Christian community, that as much as possible to dispel that skepticism and that unease around the relationship and really embrace ways that we can come together. Like, I just got an invitation yesterday to do a Passover Seder with our local temple in Birmingham. And so we're going to bring a group of Christians to come and do a Seder with the Jewish community. Anything like that, where the Jewish community can invite Christians into your traditions and into your different religious aspects, but just also community aspects. I think that's how you keep growing and creating awareness between the two people groups.
I love that. And for you or for anyone else listening, I would personally love to come and just have a conversation with in churches, in Bible study groups, in community centers. I know a lot of non-Jews have a lot of questions and really important questions. What is happening in Israel? How is this related to Jews in America? What is anti-Zionism? How is it different or not from anti-Semitism? If you'll have me, I'll come and I'll give you my perspective. So we end every episode with what I'm calling the Here I Am Lightning Round. And we made a special one, a Here I Am Lightning Round non-Jewish version.
Okay.
There's no right or wrong answer, just the first thing that comes to mind. Joan Leslie, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Oh, that is a great question. People probably don't know that I live on a diet of goldfish and Diet Coke.
Are you 17?
I know.
What is one thing people don't know about evangelical Christians?
They don't know how we are probably some of the most genuine, least religious, least condemning people. I think there's this idea about Christians that it's all judgment, it's all laws, it's all rules. And the evangelical community is some of the most generous, accepting, and compassionate people.
I have a feeling you might want to skip this one, but maybe not. You are from Alabama. You are very genteel. What is your favorite curse?
Oh, interesting. I'm not going to say it on this podcast because my mom will listen. But, you know, sometimes you do just need a good release.
Okay. When was the last time you cried?
This one's easy to answer, actually. I was telling you that when I was in Israel over the past 2 weeks, I got to meet Agam Berger. She was held hostage in Gaza in the tunnels for over 450 days. And she was released over a month ago. And I had the privilege of meeting with her and hearing a little bit about her experience as a hostage. And at the end, I asked her, I said, Agam, how can I pray for you moving forward? Like, what do you need as you are rehabilitating and coming back into society? And she looked at me with so much poise. You know, I'm crying. She's not crying. She's so strong. And she said, the only thing you can do for me is pray that the rest of the hostages come home. She said, I don't need anything else. I'm not thinking about myself, but they all have to come home. And she said, it's not a matter, you know, time is of the essence, and it's not a matter of days, it's a matter of minutes. So.
Amen. Mm-hmm. If you could be invited over for Shabbat dinner with any Jewish person in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Wow, that's a great question. Interestingly, it would be Jesus. Jesus was a rabbi. He was a Jewish rabbi. He celebrated the Sabbath. He celebrated all of the Jewish holidays. And I would love to do a Shabbat dinner with Jesus.
I would love to be there too. What is your favorite holiday?
Oh, I love Christmas. You know, I have to love Christmas.
What is your least favorite holiday?
I hate Halloween. I think it's so scary. It's so dark. You know, I want to be like festive and joyful all the time.
When do you feel safest?
I feel safest when I'm at dinner with my group of best girlfriends and we just go to a dinner and we have the ability to just completely open up, be totally ourselves. You know that you're unconditionally loved, you're unconditionally accepted, and there's people that know everything about you and love you just the same.
Will they be listening to this?
Yes, they will.
You want to give them a shout out?
Yeah. Hey, to all my friends. You guys know who you are.
When do you feel least safe?
I This is interesting. It's something that's become more apparent to me recently with the work that I'm doing supporting Israel. I didn't know that there were people in my community back home who viewed my work negatively, that really began to make preconceived notions and judgments about me because of my work on behalf of Israel. And I think that by default just made me feel insecure and unsafe in the way people were perceiving me. And it wasn't a physical security issue, but just in the way that people were perceiving me. And I had to make the decision there and then that I'm going to die to that. Whatever that fear is in me, I've got to die to that because I can't live unsafe doing what I believe in.
What gives you hope?
My work gives me hope. Like I said, the first time that I was in Israel on my very first trip, I looked at the magnitude of the work that I was doing and I thanked God that I was a part of something that was bigger than me. And my faith gives me hope on top of that. I believe that, you know, we have this phrase in Christianity that if it's not good, then God's not done. And so just believing that like God is bringing goodness to every area of our lives and in this world.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Well, I didn't know that you were going to ask this question, but we are a nonprofit. So I would love for people to support the work that we're doing, taking members of Congress to Israel. Our organization, just as a reminder, U.S. Israel Education Association. You can find us on Instagram or online at usieducation.org. We'd love to have people invest in our vision.
So the question I end with is, where can people find you? So you said the organization is...
Yeah, so we're on every social media platform. We also have a website, like I said, usieducation.org. We've got a YouTube channel, so check us out everywhere.
All right. And where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram at Joan Leslie McGill. Yeah.
Well, this was both fascinating and heartwarming and gives me a lot of hope. And I have to tell you, I am very open about the fact that I'm an atheist. I just don't have that believing bone in my body. But it still inspires me to meet people that have deep faith. And it's clear to me that your faith is genuine. And I just appreciate you as a partner in this. And here I am with Joan Leslie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."